Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CCXXVIII, Caesar versus Vercingetorix. Caesar was a man who was careful of his image, and in his accounts of the Gallic Wars, he recorded his skill and competence on the battlefield. He also made a point of giving himself a credible nemesis, with the barbarian Vercingetorix taking the centre stage. This podcast was recorded live in Albury at the Albury Library Museum on the 28th of June, 2024. Here's Rhiannon Evans. Ave, thank you all for joining us tonight. I'm Matt Smith, and I am a podcaster, and I host the Emperors of Rome podcast. And with me, as always, mostly as always, is Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans from Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. So thank you everyone for joining us. Tonight, we're going to be talking about Caesar, his image, and Vercingetorix, his foe.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I say his arch foe.
Shall we start with this lovely painting which we have behind us, which if you go down to the exhibition downstairs is on a wall in a much bigger resolution than this. So what is this painting showing? What is the context for this, Rhiannon?
So this is showing the surrender, as I say, it is a spoiler, the surrender of Vercingetorix to Caesar, and it's actually called Vercingetorix throwing his arms before the feet of Julius Caesar. It's by Lionel Royer from 1899. He's a French painter, and that will be important in the way that he happens to depict both Caesar and Vercingetorix. And Matt tells me, or maybe you're going to say this, that this is an image we used to use for our podcast. I have no memory of this.
Yeah. So Emperors of Rome is 10 years old this year. And way back when, before we started doing Emperors of Rome, it was just called Life of Caesar. And this was the tile art image that we had. And I distinctly remember that because I had to email a gallery in France.
Musée Croisier.
Yes, and I didn't even attempt any French in the email. But you emailed them separately as well and asked them about the image.
Yeah, I used it for an ebook. They were very generous and gracious. And my French was appalling, but they were nice anyway.
I think they end up getting a lot of requests. So this is that image. So we've come full circle in the 10 years then.
So this is based, maybe, on Caesar's own words. And we'll talk about his texts, the way that he depicts this war throughout the 50s BCE in a moment. So in Caesar's own words, what we see in this image is really quite brief. He says, messengers were sent to Caesar, always talks about himself in the third person, to discuss terms. He ordered them to give up their weapons and bring out the Gallic leaders. Leaders, plural. He himself took his seat in the fortifications in front of the camp. It's not bad for that. Certainly he's on a dais there, and there are fortifications, I guess, in the background there. Vercingetorix was surrendered, and his weapons were thrown down in the passive. Caesar distributed the rest of the prisoners as war plunder, one to each man throughout his whole army. So that's it. Vercingetorix threw down his arms, and then all the Gauls are enslaved. That's from very near the end of the Gallic War, Book 7, which is the last book that Caesar wrote himself. Mm. So this is kind of the climax of the whole history of the war, as far as he's concerned.
So prior to that passage, there is a battle between Caesar and Vercingetorix. So they did come to arms then, but they didn't really cross paths until that seventh year. And before then, he was bothering Gauls, bothering Germans and Britons.
Bothering is doing a lot of hard work there.
There's a lot of marauding across the countryside there for about 7 years. So what was the context for this clash in particular, and where had Vercingetorix been this entire time?
So he doesn't get mentioned until Book 7 of Caesar's work, The Gallic War. So Caesar, this is going to be very potted history of the Gallic Wars. In 58 BCE, he's allocated the province of Illyria and Cisalpine Gaul. That's not any of this. He shouldn't be there at all. This is not his province. But he basically manufactures reasons, which he tells us about in book one. There's all of these disputes going on in what he calls Further Gaul. He's got to go and sort them out. And then he spends 8 years going and sorting them out and turning this whole area, which is modern France and Belgium, a little bit of the Netherlands, into a province, which becomes, over time, three provinces. So he uses this dispute early on in what he calls, what the Romans called Gallia Comata, which means hairy Gaul, all right? So they had various kinds of Gauls. Gaul actually started in northern Italy, which is where Caesar's really meant to be, on northern Italy. And they call what is mostly France now hairy Gaul because the Gauls were hairy. We can come back to that or from their point of view. They have a province, which they call imaginatively Provincia, which is now Provence in southeast France. And they call that Gallia Brocata, which means trousered Gaul. So there's a lot about appearance here, which I'm going to stress because I'm going to talk about appearance in this painting and how Caesar describes it. That's how they designate the Gauls. And so he's going into hairy Gaul, where he shouldn't be. He has no right to be there. And some Romans back home aren't happy with that. By the end of 57, 2 years later, he says, all of Gaul was conquered, but there are a lot more books of the Gallic War, so it's not. So he has to keep going back because the Gauls keep saying, no, you haven't conquered us. And there's further resistance. Then he has various expeditions over the Rhine into what we might think of as Germany now, and over the English Channel to southern England. Throughout this time, the Gauls are really not united. And he talks a lot about how they just fall apart all of the time. They seem to form these little coalitions, but then you sort of blow a wind at them and it all breaks up. This is what happens with Vercingetorix. But this is kind of their best chance. In 52 BCE, so this is 7 years into the whole project, several powerful tribes in, I guess, eastern France joined together. And their leader is an Avernian man called Vercingetorix. That's the first time we hear about him, right at the beginning of book seven. Nobody has ever talked about him before in any texts we have. And it's a very long book. It's the longest book of the whole Gallic War. And after being defeated at a major battle, so he does get defeated, Caesar wins out at this really brutal siege, which is sort of in the background there at a place called Alesia, which you can still go to, and Vercingetorix is forced to surrender. So that gets us back to where we started with the surrender. Then there's a couple more years of war, clearly not very interesting to Caesar. Somebody else writes it up, one of his generals.
Okay. We've mentioned book a couple of times, yeah. And it's probably worth dwelling on the fact that Caesar wrote up his commentaries or had somebody write them up on his behalf, where he spoke about himself in third person, mm-hmm. as you had in your quote there. These were very much a piece of propaganda. He sends these back to Rome. Somebody stands on a street corner and can read it out to the masses.
That's one theory about how they're used. Yeah, I think it's a good one.
Also in the Senate, I guess, maybe, mm-hmm. if they want to give it some time. So how was he presenting himself in that kind of thing? And how was he using the Gauls in that? Was Vercingetorix part of that? I kind of get the impression that he got to book seven and said, oh, I'm not hooking the audience in enough. I need a credible enemy.
So Vercingetorix is kind of the most standout Gaul of the whole narrative. We don't see that many other who are named and get defined. While he's dealing with actual history, right, he can't just make it all up. I don't think Vercingetorix is invented. But I think that he dwells on him because this is the kind of biggest crisis in his war. This is the final act of a movie, if you like. It's the same kind of principle. So he builds him up as this credible, dangerous enemy who only Caesar can defeat.
Mm. Mm. Was his commentaries used in that way, do you think, that he used them as a way of communicating back in Rome what he was doing and how great his battles were and everything? Yeah. I feel if Caesar was around now, he would have been big on TikTok. That, yeah. You know, he would have had a social media presence. He would have had media management. I would have had a job.
That's true. Yeah, I think he might have been more of a YouTuber, a bit more long form, not the YouTube shorts. So yeah, this is going back, and without going through the whole Gallic War text, it's pretty clear that the times that the Romans lose, Caesar's not there. He's had to go and do something somewhere else. There's always crises all over the place. every year during the winter, they don't fight during the winter, he goes back to Illyricum, which is basically Croatia now, which is, remember, one of the places he's meant to be, to do the assizes, to hear law cases. And that's when things start to go wrong, when he's not around. And it's some other general's fault. So it absolutely is propaganda. Because when he turns up, and he turns up, as we'll see, very quickly all the time, Caesar moves fast. So that's something that there are so many adjectives that mean fast associated with Caesar in this work. And that's really important for him. Because when he gets back to Rome, and he stays much longer in Gaul than is normal for a governor of any province. But when he gets back, he needs to make sure that he can run for a magistracy, not least because somebody's probably going to charge him with something, so one of his enemies, and he needs to be popular. So this is good for his political career.
Mm. So to bring it back slightly to this painting then, how carefully did he manage his image? I'm wondering if he'd look at how he's being represented here and be happy with that sort of thing, or even how he's being represented on the front of that lovely Asterix book.
I'm very displeased with this.
Which I'm completely taking home with me. It is mine. I'm not just stealing from the library.
I think there are different degrees here of French anti-Caesar propaganda going on, because the French still see Vercingetorix as a great hero. There's a huge statue of him at Alesia, where that final siege was. So he's a kind of tragic hero, I guess, in a way that I think that both Brits and Australians would understand. It's the kind of thing we commemorate too. Caesar was really concerned with his image, not just that I'm a brilliant general, but also with how he appeared. So this, which kind of satirizes, there's a bust downstairs in the exhibition of Caesar, and this is a version of it, but it's exaggerated. It's kind of a cartoonish version, literally, where his nose is made much bigger. I think, you know, he's got more chins, I think. These are all things not seen as attractive in antiquity. And he's really concerned about his hairline. I'm going to read you, it's a bit of a long quote now, from Suetonius, the biography of Caesar, the deified Julius Caesar, chapter 45, if you want to look it up. He is said to have been tall with a light complexion, shapely limbs, I'm not sure what that means, a fairly full face and keen black eyes. He was healthy, except towards the end of his life was subject to sudden fainting fits and to nightmares as well. He was twice attacked by the falling sickness, which is epilepsy, during his campaigns. He was a bit over-concerned with his appearance. This is deeply suspect to the Romans, like a man being concerned about his appearance. And was not only carefully trimmed and shaved, so I told you hair would come back. Romans are famously clean-shaven at this period. Downstairs, you'll see other statue busts of later emperors in the 2nd century CE. From the Emperor Hadrian onwards, they start to go bearded for the philosopher look. But at this point, that's a lot later, that's 200 years later. At this point, they tend to be clean-shaven. But Suetonius is kind of making it, although Suetonius is writing at the time of Hadrian, so that's a complication here. He's making a point that Caesar's particularly careful with keeping himself free of hair. Because he goes on to say, not only carefully trimmed and shaved, but also had his body hair plucked out. Now, this is unusual for Roman men. His baldness, though, was a problem, which troubled him greatly, as he found that it was often the subject of his enemies' jokes. I don't know whether, see what you think as I continue reading, if this is being depicted here, whether Royer had gone and read Suetonius and decided to incorporate it. Because of it, he used to comb forward his scanty locks from the crown of his head. So he's kind of doing a forward comb over. And of all the honors voted him by the Senate and people, there was none which he received or made use of more gladly than the privilege of wearing a laurel wreath at all times. So you can see he is wearing a laurel wreath in this painting. But the suggestion is that it covers over any lack of hair that's going on there. And Matt is also modelling.
Full head of hair still. Full head of hair.
He doesn't need it.
Not yet, not quite.
They say too that he was remarkable in his dress, that he wore a senator's tunic with fringed sleeves reaching to the waist, which is a bit odd. The fringe is elaborate. There's a bit too much elaboration going on here. And he always had a belt over it, though rather a loose one. Interesting point. That, they say, was the occasion of Sulla, who's kind of the generation before Caesar, dictator in Rome, saying when he often warned the senators to keep an eye on the badly belted boy.
So what's the inference there? You can get out of your toga quickly.
Well, it just seems to have implied that you were a bit loose with kind of sexual morality, but also generally that you were degenerate in some way.
Okay.
So I hope your belt is
nice and tight. Nice and tight.
Done up there. Yeah. Like, and Caesar, if this is... Now, remember, Suetonius is writing this 200 years after Caesar. But he's got this reputation. And it seems to be that Caesar and some of the emperors who are going to come along after Caesar's time play a bit fast and loose with what is expected of a respectable elite Roman man. All right, that they will... And the very tight kind of... very restrictive clothing codes. So wearing the toga, very important when you're back at Rome. Here, Caesar, that's not meant to be a toga, I don't think. This is a general's cloak, but there's a lot of material in there, and you will see downstairs, I think, more accurate representations of soldier, military clothing, military garb, and even the kind of most material in a general's cloak is not as much as this. So I think Royer has kind of gone overboard in showing Caesar to have very elaborate clothing. Of course, you get a lot of that very deep red out of it because that's the color it's being depicted in here. That's a very expensive color for the Romans. So Caesar, that makes a general stand out. So that is accurate, but it wouldn't have been as voluminous as that. He's got the little skirt on underneath the leather skirt, which is normal for soldiers. And he's got his laurel wreath on there, which that hasn't been awarded to him yet. So if he's wearing that, it's a bit out of place. So yeah, he's kind of playing with some of the sources. But, you know, Caesar's got his own take on the way of looking, which I think Royer is further, taking a step further.
So what you read out there was from Suetonius, yes. Though, and you mentioned at one point that he could have been getting his facts from the gutter press, but also Suetonius was a bit of a gossip monger. So Caesar would have managed his appearance a lot more carefully than this, wouldn't he? He definitely doesn't talk about himself like this in his own commentaries, for example.
He doesn't talk about what he wears at all in his commentaries.
Yeah.
It's more about his actions. He's a man of action.
So how is he portraying himself then? He's a man of action. You mentioned he was running around very fast, which is a good thing for the Romans and a very impressive thing when you're taking an entire army with you when you're running.
It's a good thing for the Romans that he's efficient and fast, but I think it must have been dreadful for his army.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're forced marches all the time. And, you know, they get their double quick time.
Sorry, forced marches are where... whenever anyone's having a break, the other ones are marching on, and you've got a kind of like overlapping kind of thing where the army's continuously moving. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And it often gets, he says, you know, we got there twice as fast as the normal travel time. Because it's, for antiquity, vast distances that they're taking, sometimes by ship, and he doesn't always explain to us how he got places fast. But this works very well for him. So much earlier than what is being depicted here, right near the start of the war, back in 57 BC, he says these Belgic tribes and the Belgae were known for being the really tough Gauls. So I said this once at a talk, and a colleague of mine who's from Belgium said, yes! they're kind of hard to beat. You know, Caesar thinks he's pacified everyone even after the first year, and the Belgae rise up. And so at the start of book two, he's like, oh, I've heard these rumors, so let's go and deal with this group of people called the Remi. And he says, so I'm reading from Caesar here. Again, it's a bit of a long quote, but bear with me. Reports of Gallic uprising prompted Caesar to enroll two new legions in Gaul. So, you know, that would take a while, you'd think, but this is fast. And as soon as they began to gather food supplies, he's always really concerned about food supplies for his army,
lots of grain.
I am a good leader, is what he's saying. He himself came to the army, so he's come from, you know, Illyrica. He sought information from the neighboring friendly Gauls, and when they reported that an army was being assembled, he determined he must no longer hesitate. He secured his grain supply, dwelling on that, left his camp, and in about a fortnight reached the borders of the Belgae. So he's come from Croatia to Belgium. And, you know, I know that doesn't sound very fast to us, but it is. He arrived there, this is the important part of this, he arrived there unexpectedly and with more speed than anyone had expected. The Remi, the Belgic tribe nearest to Gaul, sent their leaders to tell him they had surrendered. So instantly, he doesn't even have to fight. They surrendered themselves, all their possessions, to the protection and power of Rome, saying they had not taken part with the rest of the Belgae. It wasn't us, honest sir, nor conspired against Rome. And they were ready to give hostages, to do his commands, to receive him in their towns, and to assist him with grain and anything else. So this is really effective, getting there fast and showing your power, at least as Caesar presents himself. So it's very much about this great image of, I haven't wasted our money and our troops in an unnecessary battle. My kind of quick reaction to this means we've just defeated these incredibly tough people who I told you in book one were the toughest of the Gauls, who are everyone else is terrified of. And I was so good, I didn't even have to fight them.
You beat them with a scheduling error.
Yeah. Yeah, he's like, I know, I think Caesar would have won with Excel or something. Just having the right calendar just set up.
As per my email. Yeah. So how does this contrast then with how he's portraying Vercingetorix and the images of the Gauls? You've said we've got hairy Gauls, trousered Gauls, impressive moustache Gauls. So how is he portraying them? They're just full-out barbarians, aren't they?
Not completely.
They're brave barbarians.
Yes, not even completely that. All right, they have been brave in the past. The Belgae are still fairly brave, those Belgians. But there's a kind of idea that they're on the slide. All right, the really tough guys are over the Rhine in Germania, in Germany. So that makes them kind of ripe for conquest. He doesn't say that, but that's kind of the implication. But also, they are really disorganized. As I've said already, they cannot keep anything together. They do a coalition, it falls apart. Lots of times they try and do this. And Vercingetorix kind of embodies this. He's the unity candidate at the beginning of book seven, but it doesn't last. And this is because the Gauls are always suspicious of each other. Given what's going to happen in the following decade from this, with the Romans at each other's throats, and they have been already a few decades before, this is kind of slightly ironic. But he really plays on these times the Gauls fail to gel. So the other Gauls, they end up handing Vercingetorix over because they think it's his fault that he's failed. They get rid of him at the end. If we see this as a bit as a literary text as well as a historical one, Caesar's Gallic Wars, right at the beginning, before he even mentions himself or the Romans, he says, there's this guy called Orgetorix, and he's from this little bit of what we now think of as Switzerland, from Helvetia. The Germans are coming over the Rhine, they're pushing them out, so they get a band of people together and decide they're going to take over the whole of Gaul. And within about two paragraphs, he's dead because it's all fallen apart, they've turned against him. Other people are complaining about what the Helvetia have done, and that's why they say, Caesar, please come and help us, and he has to come into Gaul. So this happens at the beginning of the Gallic War book, and it happens at the end. The Gauls fall apart. They cannot keep together. And they also fear that whatever leader rises up, or Getarix or Vercingetorix, that they're going to try and become king of all Gaul. All right, so they're going to become a tyrant. So there's this fear of tyranny, again, quite ironic, given that this Gallic unity is actually going to occur under the ultimate tyranny of the Romans coming and literally putting their military boot on top of Gaul. They think Orgetorix might be trying to be king. They think Vercingetorix's dad might have tried to be king. We don't know anything about him except Caesar mentions that, so he gets driven out. And then they're kind of a bit fearful that Vercingetorix is trying. So the reason they can't keep it together is that they suspect that whoever rises up is just going to try and take over and dominate them.
Mm. So we've talked about Caesar's image and how he's portraying himself and how this image behind us stacks up. So for Vercingetorix, does this kind of thing ring true with how he's being portrayed?
Well, Caesar doesn't describe him at all, really. He describes him as charismatic. He gives him some good speeches, which he cannot have known anything about. He will have made them up, which is normal for ancient history. All right, that's okay. They wouldn't have said that was fake news.
How about Gauls in particular, though?
What do you mean?
The way that this is depicting him. He didn't talk about Vercingetorix. Did he talk about Gauls?
Yeah, he talks about them as being, as you mentioned at the beginning, kind of barbarians, as being tall, big, laughing at the Romans. We might get time to have a look at that. Laughing at them because they're short. And then getting a shock because they're tough. You know, they're a big military machine. So they are depicted as tough. The hairstyling in this painting of Vercingetorix seems to actually be more based on what he says about the Britons. So he doesn't talk that much about the Gauls' physical appearance, except that they're big and burly. But given that I am from the UK, I do want to read you what he says about the Britons. And this is a bit of a tangent, but indulge me. This is in book five, where he does a little bit of, he goes over to Britain twice and doesn't hang around because it's not worth it. All the Britons indeed dye themselves with woad. So that's the first time you get mentioned that they paint themselves blue, which produces a blue colour and makes their appearance in battle more terrible. So that explains
Braveheart.
Yeah. They wear long hair, weird for the Romans, and shave every part of their body save the head and the upper lip, which is ironic given what Suetonius says about Caesar plucking hair out of his body. All right, so I don't know, I don't think there's enough detail to see whether Vercingetorix's arms have had all the hair plucked out of them, but you can see the upper lip hair is quite prominent there in some kind of, looks like Kenneth Branagh's Poirot mustache almost. So that idea that the weird barbarians have hair in places we wouldn't have it in, they have this long hair, they pluck out other hair, but they've got these monstrous mustaches, is coming from there, I think. And I think Royer might be playing on that in the way that he depicts Vercingetorix. So he's kind of gone, oh, a bit of British ethnography, let's just shove it onto this super Gaul.
But this is all in itself a work of propaganda as well, isn't it? So the way that he's portrayed him on horseback, the way that he's drawing your eye to Vercingetorix.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you asked me whether Caesar would be pleased with this. I think he'd be very displeased that Vercingetorix is depicted higher up because he's on his horse. All right, so where you are, it still matters with things like, I don't know, movie posters, whose name is at the top, whose name is higher up.
Or who's larger on the movie poster, and who's
exactly
a peripheral character.
So we do get our eye drawn to Julius Caesar, but this is really the dominant figure, and it shouldn't really surprise us given that Royer is French and he's celebrating this, what the French regard as a hero who had a tragic end. He's got a magnificent horse and he's got, you know, lots of colour in his costume. No idea whether any of this is authentic. It's a way of drawing our attention to him, this lovely yellow cloak that he's wearing, gold, I guess it is. A lot of gold there. Gold tends to get associated with the Gauls, and you can see he's got that kind of torque around his arm. And the earrings, I don't know where they're from. There may be some archaeology to back this up, but I think he's been quite imaginative. So we do get this very bare depiction of this in Caesar. But we've got another version from another biographer of Caesar, which I think might be playing into this too. So this is from a Greek guy called Plutarch, who's alive about 150 years after Caesar. And he says, about the middle of the life of Caesar, Vercingetorix, the supreme leader in the whole war, put on his most beautiful armor. Check. Had his horse carefully groomed, so there's a horse here, which there isn't in Caesar, and rode out through the gates. Caesar was sitting down. Check. And Vercingetorix, after riding round him in a circle, this is pretty bold for a man who's surrendering, leapt down from his horse, stripped off his armor, and sat at Caesar's feet, silent and motionless, until he was taken away in arrest, a prisoner reserved for Caesar's triumph. So we don't get the kind of, you know, the abasement part of it. We get the sitting on the horse, proud, in all of his kind of glory, in all of his beautiful armor. It gives him a lot more agency in this painting. And I guess the painting, because it is a moment in time, cuts off before we have to have the sat at Caesar's feet, silent and motionless. This is the prancing around at the beginning part.
This was painted in 1899, but Royer was born in 1852, which was the start of the reign of Napoleon. Sorry, I've gone rogue. This is the start of the reign of Napoleon III. So he grew up in that era, and Napoleon III is the one, didn't you say, who put up the statue of Vercingetorix?
Napoleon III was really interested in Julius Caesar and tried to excavate the battlefield and wrote these huge voluminous tomes about Caesar, because for French and Italian and lots of European leaders, Caesar is a role model. So there's a bit of the British have this as well. It's a bit of a weird relationship going on with the Romans, because the Romans defeated their ancestors, but at the same time, they are these exemplars of power and conquest. So admirable in their view if they're trying to build an empire. So I think that's what's going on here. Yeah, you're right to mention Napoleon III.
So since we're talking about this image then, how did Caesar extend this sort of victory on the battlefield with Roman might versus the primitive barbarians?
Let me exemplify that by talking about what I sort of alluded to a bit before, which is he really tries to draw this contrast between the Gauls as big and tough, but not very organized, and also not realizing what they're up against. So it's very cinematic, and someone should make a movie of it, although it would be so brutal. I mean, there is an estimate that Caesar and his armies killed 1 million Gauls during this conquest, which, you know, given the size of the population in the 50s BCE is just devastating. And we see that, for example, in the way that he talks about the siege at Alesia. I mean, that's just devastating. And he talks about it very matter-of-factly. So at Alesia, which is where Vercingetorix is finally defeated, this brutal siege, there are kind of two rings of fortifications around the city of Alesia that the Romans make. So one ring so they can fight Gauls that are coming in from the outside, and one ring to stop the people of Alesia getting out, to put pressure on them to surrender. And at one point he says some of the people came out from the city and tried to beg for mercy. And he just says, you know, no, we didn't give them any. And then a later historian draws the implication of that, that they were just left between these two rings of Roman fortifications to starve to death. They're just there. They're begging for mercy. They're saying, you know, take us as slaves, and the Romans won't take them. Caesar says no. So there's that going on. And you can see some of these in the exhibition. You can see some of the kind of assault towers that they used, versions of those in these sieges, which you always know it's to do with a siege if there's a kind of tall structure and then a platform. And the platform is for the army that's besieging to be underneath, because the people in the city are going to throw things out at you, so you need somewhere to be protected. And then there's a tower above that where you might be able to fling things in yourself. It's not pretty.
So the organization of it and the technology and the efficiency and the Caesar moving very fast, all of this would have been a very overwhelming force to fight against. And the fact that this painting and that Julius Caesar is kind of glorified in modern France, did you say, to a certain extent? I see a big kind of conflict in, you know, we're glorifying somebody who murdered quite a lot of our ancestors. Yeah.
I think it's something that all of those 19th century empires grapple with, the Romans as role models, and if they're Europeans, probably the Romans as conquerors, because they did have the biggest empire of anywhere up until that time. Yeah, and you know, Caesar likes to make that comparison between our organization and the unexpectedness of it. If I had one word to sum up the way Caesar describes this invasion of Gaul, it's that everything is unexpected. Let me read you just one more quote. This is back in book 2 of the Gallic Wars, and the Romans are yet again conducting a siege of a people called the Aduatuci. They have a double wall of great height, and this is the Aduatuci, and they were setting stones of great weight and sharpened beams upon the wall. The Romans construct these siege works, much to the amusement of the Aduatuci, who, quote, first of all, laughed at us from the wall, and loudly railed upon us for building so great a siege engine at so great a distance. By what handiwork, they said, by what strength could men, especially of so puny a stature, hope to set so heavy a tower on the wall? So the Romans are too little to move these great machines. And Caesar explains, for as a rule, our stature, short by comparison with their own huge physique, is despised by the Gauls. So they kind of put all of their trust in we're big and there are lots of us. That's the other thing Caesar says about the Gauls, there are loads of them. Right? They're just everywhere. But as soon as they see that the siege works can move, they send envoys to negotiate. This is the kind of pattern that we see here. Let's look really scary, and they'll just say, oh, please, let's come to terms over this. And they submitted themselves and all that they had to the power of Rome, which is a bit of a motif that comes up throughout Caesar's work. They think that Rome must have divine aid, indeed.
That was Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe, leave a review, or tell your friends about it. We're on any readily available podcatching platform. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can also follow us on what is left of Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. This episode of Emperors of Rome was recorded in Albury on the traditional lands of the Wiradjuri people and produced at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.